Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is the internationally acclaimed novelist and screenwriter Ian McEwan. He is the author of Atonement, which won the Booker Prize, and many other bestsellers, including Saturday, Chesil Beach, and Machines Like Me. His latest novel is exquisite. It's set in 2014 and in 2119, more than 100 years from now. It's suspenseful, complex, more than a little frightening, and very funny. I found it to be a brilliant peroration about how history is often a distorted prism through which we view ourselves in the present moment. It was released last week. It's called What We Can Know. Ian McEwan and I will talk about the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library, and he joins us today on midday on Zoom from New York. Ian, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.
And this book is a real triumph. I think it's just great. I'm an avid reader of your work. I've been reading you for years. I can't profess to having read everything you've written. This is your 19th novel. You write quite a lot. I haven't read all of them, but I've read most of them, I think. And I think this is just a wonderful, wonderful book. So congratulations and thank you.
Well, thank you.
you've described this as science fiction without the science. What do you mean by that?
Well, I admire a great deal of science fiction, especially when it wants to address how technology has its impacts on our societies and our civilization even. But I wanted to sort of speculate about the future, contemplate it without the science, and ask instead, you know, what is the future of history? What is the future of the humanities, of our, or even the future of love itself, you know, of truth? So, yeah, no gravity, anti-gravity boots, no spacecraft, no intergalactic warfare here. It's a young academic working in a rather dowdy department of humanities in a university perched on a hilltop for safety from floods. And he's looking back on our time, which was another way of, you know, just trying to address who we are and what we are and what's going on with us.
Yeah, and that's really one of the great fascinating dimensions of the novel, that we're looking back on the year 2014 from the year 2119, and the limits of what we can know, and the way we garner information and gather information. You have to, one of the things you have to do is imagine what the world is like after a nuclear disaster, climate change. You mentioned this academic is in a school that perched on a hill so that it can avoid the floods. I mean, all of Great Britain, or most of it, is in this novel an archipelago. I mean, it's covered with water. How did you come to a determination of what the Earth will look like in 2119, excuse me?
Well, the reader should understand this is not prophecy. This is speculation, of course. I don't even know what's going to happen next week. But climate change, even at the alarming rate which it's continuing to trouble us, will not deliver more than about a meter, maybe 70 centimeters of sea level rise. But in this scenario, there is a limited nuclear war. A Russian thermonuclear bomb lands in the mid-Atlantic and sends a set of giant tsunamis to the west coast of Africa, to Western Europe, and the eastern seaboard of the United States. And what with heavy rainfalls, because there's so much moisture in the air, an awful lot of inland lakes have formed. And they, of course, compress the earth beneath them. And so rather like glacial lakes, they become a permanent feature. And it's been a rather bumpy 21st century. I simply extend my line from the present, for the first 25 years. And we'll limp from crisis to crisis with the odd catastrophe thrown in. Some good news along the way too. And England's a very, very sleepy place by the 21-19 year. It's been very oppressed by the past, much like the rest of the 21st century. And my researcher looks back on us not only with despair at all the things we failed to do and the problems we failed to resolve, but with a lot of envy too. He lists, you know, a golden telescope a million miles out on Earth, the James Webb telescope, incredible advances in various branches of science, including software development, of course, beginnings of AI, whether that's a plus or minus, we might discuss, but also you know, knowledge expanding about the cosmos. And he sees us as sort of a risk-taking society, intellectually adventurous, but crazy too, you know, flying thousands of miles for a vacation, a couple of guys playing golf on the moon some years back. And he admires then, you know, the gay pride marches, the rock and roll, the amazing music festivals, et cetera, football matches that 4 billion people are watching all at once. Meanwhile, of course, we know exactly what to do to fix climate change, but we don't seem to be able to do it. Powerful interests stand in our way. And he's investigating a poem, and rather unlikely. It's written by a very famous poet, Francis Blundy. He reads it aloud at a dinner party for friends and family. It is a present for his wife. He's got rid of all the previous drafts. There's only one copy. He's written it out in fair hand on a piece of vellum, and he presents it to his wife, Vivian Blundy. And she takes it, she thanks him, but we do not know what happened to that poem. And for the succeeding generations, right through for the next 100 years, the guests at that dinner write about it, talk about it, and it becomes very famous. And people project onto it, onto those blank pages, their own obsessions, their own aspirations, their own fears. And my researcher, Tom Medcalf, traces the 21st century through those missing pages of a poem and gives us a kind of history, basically, of what happens. And it's just a story of a quest. He's absolutely certain that poem still exists. And in its second half, which takes a very different view of everything, we learn a little more about that poem and a great deal more about that poet. And somewhere in there are many love affairs and many betrayals and a crime, a very, very serious crime that my young researcher knows nothing about. So it's constantly asking the question, what can we know, as you mentioned it in your introduction, about ourselves, about the past, about the guesses we must make about the future, and also, you know, what are our responsibilities to that future.
Ian McEwan is my guest. His latest novel is a gem. It's called What We Can Know. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Ian, what is fascinating about your handling of this mythology that grows out of this poem, as you mentioned, it's read at this dinner party. It's never published. People speculate as to, you know, what it's about and how it was received. You make the literary decision not to include the poem in the novel. So we as the reader never read the poem either.
And I haven't read it. Yeah. I haven't read it either.
Yeah. So did you, I wondered if you toyed with the idea of writing a poem or writing parts of this. It's called A Corona for Vivian. It's a series of sonnets, as you mentioned, it for her birthday. I wonder if you toyed with the idea of, you know, giving the reader a glimpse into it. This would have been something that the main character doesn't have.
Well, I certainly did, Tom. I wrote out of, you know, occasionally scattered through the text a one or two line quotations from the poem. Now, this poem is meant to be brilliant. It's all everyone around the table who heard it attests to it being perhaps the greatest poem that this wonderful poet has written, and maybe one of the most important poems in the literature. So that would be quite a tall order. Anyway, I had a go at it. And then when I finished an important draft in the stage of drafts, I showed it to an old friend who always sees my my very earliest manifestations of any novel I've written. We go back maybe 25 years in this. And he said he loved the novel very much. But then, of course, you know, we come to the reservations, the sting in the tail. And he said, listen, you're not a poet, face it. And
a harsh truth.
Yeah, thanks a lot. We still remain friends. He gave me one of those notes, and like all good notes in any artistic project, when you hear it, you recognize straight away that it's a good note. He said, this will work much better if you take out all of those quotations. So we the reader, don't know what the poem is. Maybe we're going to find out at the end. That's one of the kind of question marks that hangs over the reading of this novel. And it would be all the better for your wretched attempts at great poetry. So I'm of that generation that believes that you don't become a poet just by writing a poem. T.S. Eliot said, if you wish to be a poet, you've really got to get down to it in your early 20s and spend the rest of your life doing it. Just because you might be feeling good one day and want to impress your friends and dash one off on the back of an envelope does not make you a poet. I'm a novelist, and I had to accept I am not a great poet.
But you are clearly well-versed in poetry. Do you read a lot of poetry? Have you written poetry, you know, maybe that you don't show anybody other than your best friends?
I once wrote a villanelle, which is a very complex little poem structure. And that got published in Britain. And I read a great deal of poetry. I regard it really as the senior form to the novel. Its history is thousands of years older than the novel. It has much to do with the very pulse and heartbeat of our living in its rhythms and its wonderful sense of usually addressing love or the glories of landscape or the heroism of a figure like Odysseus. And in its condensation of language, I think it reaches the highest points in our aspiration to transform thoughts and feelings and experiences into words. The novel was a bit of a Johnny come lately. We've been developing these last 200 or 300 years. It has strengths that the novel, that the poetry does not have, that poetry cannot quite reach to. But still, I have to say that when I was sitting around talking to my late friend Martin Amis, we often talked about poetry rather than fiction, and we accepted that it was, as people in the army in Britain used to say of the Navy, it was the senior service.
The senior service, and poetry being senior to the novel is a fascinating observation. Also, you write this is a great funny line in the book about the performance of poetry. People like Francis Blundy, your main character, one of the main characters, does a lot of poetry readings because, as you mentioned, he's a very well-known, famous poet. And you write, people thought he read well. He didn't adopt the derided high priest sing-song of Yeats or Eliot's bogus crooning, and he despised the shambling apologetic tone that was the current fashion.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of that's a cute little indictment of poetry readings there.
Yeah. Well, I've been to many poetry readings given by poets whom I adore enormously, and they do come shambling onto the stage, a lot of them, and saying, oops, where are my glasses? And oops, I don't have the right page here. And everyone's meant to, and everyone obliges with little titters of sort of endorsement and support. And here's one I wrote. It's not really good, but I'm still working on it. I said, come on, be bold. Give us your love of poetry in a warm expression, and you know, have the energy to look up every now and then and meet us in the eye. And that's why, of course, I admire those poets like James Fenton and Alice Oswald, who remember their own poetry so they can really look up from the page and look straight into the eyes of their audience. Then you really are engaged.
Yeah.
So I think a little showbiz
never hurt anybody, right?
Well, quite. I mean, people come long distance. You know, they might have paid a few dollars. They're sitting on hard chairs. Come on, give them a break. Be bold. Be expressive. Wave your arms about. Do something.
Do something.
Stop apologizing.
Ian McEwan, his latest novel is What We Can Know. We will continue our conversation on the other side of a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the show, a conversation about career and technical education in Baltimore City public schools. How can our school system equip young workers with the skills they need to succeed in an employment landscape that is changing so rapidly? Plus, Gabe Ortiz breaks down the Ravens breakdown on Monday night. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the award-winning best-selling author Ian McEwan. We're talking about his latest novel. It's his 19th. It's a love story. It's really several love stories about a love poem, an insightful conjecture about how we will be known and understood in history, and how, regardless of the avidity with which any generation explores its past, there are limits to how much can really be known. The book is called What We Can Know. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. So you have written in about many topical subjects. Your wonderful novel, Saturday, followed the 9/11 attacks. You wrote on climate crisis, the climate crisis before, in a novel called Solar. That was 15 years ago or so. You wrote about AI in a novel called Machines Like Me. Did you set out to write about climate again with this novel? I mean, I know Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, a wonderful Nigerian-American author whom I've had a chance to talk to many times. Last time I talked to her about her latest novel, she said, novels aren't really about what they're about. There's always something underneath. I wonder how you react to that observation, and did you set out to make this, you know, a climate change novel sort of originally, and then have these other shoots come off it? How did you structure it?
Well, it was specifically not a climate change novel as such. In fact, I think it's very difficult to write climate change novels if you just want to address the whole matter head on. It's so large. it's not only the science and many, many branches of science, but there are politics, statistics, elements of existential anxiety, and almost too much for any small novel to address. So the best way is to not write about it, but sort of put it in as a given. Just take it for granted. It's already here, so warning people about it is, I think it's too late to be warning.
You give it a name. It's really ingenious. This period has come to be known. The period we're living in now has come to be known as the derangement.
Yes, some are already using this term, and I use it specifically to suggest that we're all complicit in it. We can't just blame the fossil fuel lobby and all the money that's granted to them, or governments that don't see the point of this, as this current administration does. We are all living energy-rich lives. We're depending on fossil fuels. We fly thousands of miles for a weekend holiday. And we are very energy intensive in the West, in the developed world, the USA in particular. So the derangement is just the folly that we're all involved in. Many of us now, because we've been going on about this in my life, it's been a concern for almost 30 years. People are bored with it. You know, they look away, and it's a kind of madness to do so, because we're all going to suffer, and our children and grandchildren will suffer. So it's a sort of mass folly, and derangement catches that better than climate emergency or climate change, which is the mildest term we have. So I think you have to, I start somewhere else. I started with a poem, and people ask me what I was writing about when I was doing this novel. I always find that a hard question to answer, because I don't want to put into words what I'm still trying to form. So I'd say, oh, I'm writing a novel about a lost sonnet sequence, at which their eyes glaze over and the subject changes, and that maintain my privacy on this. But it was really about, you know, the fact that we live wedged between the ghosts of the past, about whom we know something, and the ghosts of the future. We are shortly to become the future's ghosts. We will become part of that ever-growing past. And yet we somehow feel we're on the summit of history. We're at the cutting edge of time. We know far more than the past ever knew about itself. We're privileged, as it were, of this view from the top of the mountain. But we know that soon we will be those ghosts. And that relationship between past, present, and future was really what I wanted to start with. Could I get them somehow in the reader's mind to become one entity, both at the personal level, in the fates of various love affairs? Could I somehow merge the notion of future societies with the present, and ours with the past? What it's like to be someone's past, what it's like for us to be someone's past, rather preoccupied me. So the novel plunges into private lives, because it's not all about, you know, floods and the rest. That's simply the background in which a personal quest takes place, the discovery of a crime, and the discovery really of the realities of the private life. So yes, inevitably, if you write a history of the 21st century, you can't avoid the fact that climate change is going to be a growing element of this. So I'm aware too of a discussion that goes on, a fascinating discussion among climate change writers, novelists, I mean, who are addressing climate change. Can we use the current form of the novel, the realist novel, that focuses well on private relationships, on the everyday, and of the relationship between individuals and their society? Can we encompass the vastness of climate change within that form? And do we need new forms of the novel? My sense of this, although I love the conversation, my sense of this is actually we do need those investigations of private lives, because it's only through the personal that we can sort of relate to our future, relate to how we will be, and discover what might be the future of history, if you like, how we will look back, especially once we have become those ghosts.
And one of your characters addresses that in this novel. And by the way, let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Ian McEwan about his latest novel, the title of which is What We Can Know, here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. But Ian, one of your characters addresses this. She's a lover, a companion of the researcher you mentioned, Tom Metcalf. And she writes from the year 2119 that the finest literature was between 2050 and 2060, the 2050s and 2060s. So, which is an interesting look back on our future, our current future. Is the best yet to come? Is this, and do you even think that this right now is a kind of fallow period of literature? I mean, your character Rose writes a monograph called The Crisis of Realism in Fiction. Says that the convention of fictional realism, with its close attention to the mundane and the personal and assumed continuity of everyday life, were inadequate. So this is what you're getting at here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's in the nature of humankind that every now and then there'll be geniuses, and literature will have no shortage of subject matter. And I don't know if you remember this, but there are two scenes in bookshops. One, Tom Metcalf watches a video taken 100 years before of a typical bookshop. This one is in Oxford. And he just is stunned by the tables groaning with history books, not just history books, but recent history books, and the fiction section stretching away into the distance, the bright colors of the covers, the extraordinary inventiveness, the books on science subjects for the layman, autobiography, memoirs. And he's exhilarated. He's so much wishes he could be transferred through time from his rather sleepy, conventional, hard-pressed world of England in 2119, where industrial civilization has collapsed, supply chains have gone. People still get by, they scrape through. And then there's another scene narrated by a completely different character. It's in our time. She's in somewhere on the Upper East Side of New York, goes into a bookshop, sees all those same novels, all those same history books, all that same plenitude, and she just feels so overwhelmed by it. She wants to lie down on the floor and go to sleep. She just it can't take it anymore. I'll never read all these books, she feels. And she feels somewhat inadequate, you know, in relation to her own work. So I guess by having someone look back on us, I also want to suggest that we're surrounded by treasures that we barely appreciate and rarely celebrate because we're too fixed on daily politics, daily disasters, and so on. We still have gorgeous landscapes to walk through, for example.
Yeah, and in 2119, they pined for those because it was all underwater. And you make this really wonderful observation. As natural beauty declines over the years, and the natural beauty in this novel, is covered with water, so too unnoticed do standards of beauty. So if we're not encountering beauty, the standards we have for what is beautiful are attenuated.
Yeah, so that's called the baseline effect. In our present time, I speculate that, and I'm describing here a rather lovely landscape in Gloucestershire in West England, of trees, rolling hills, distant church spires. But someone from 100 years ago, from say 1900, walking through that same landscape, would be rather distressed to find that there are barely any wildflowers, that mostly nettles, which get encouraged by the kinds of chemicals that are dumped on fields. Very few butterflies. I mean, in 1900, you could still go out in the country and walk through clouds. But then go back another 100 years, and that person would say, why are all these fields enclosed? What's happened here? Where are all the trees? And maybe go back 1,000 years. Europe lost 80% of its tree cover by the 12th century. So, our standards are constantly lowering, and we need to pay attention to the fact that our standards of beauty can go down with them. But for all that, we are surrounded by astonishing cities, beautiful landscapes, amazing suspension bridges. And then all the fun, the street parties, the extraordinary sports, and so on. And it's only by grasping just how lively and interesting and often beautiful our surroundings and our societies are that we will fight, I think, to preserve them. Without that sense, and a sense of how it can be ruined, without a sense of what we have and what we value, I think we really run the risk of becoming moribund ourselves.
Well, by my standards of beauty, this novel is a beautiful, formidable, compelling, provocative work, and it's a delight to be able to speak about it with my guest, Ian McEwan. It's called What We Can Know. We'll have more with Ian McEwan after a quick break here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Ian McEwan, the British novelist and screenwriter. He's published 19 novels and 2 collections of short stories. He's also written screenplays, and several of his novels have been adapted as films. Today we're talking about his latest book, What We Can Know. The story centers around a poem written in 2014 by a famous poet to his wife on her birthday. More than 100 years later, 2 scholars wrestle with the challenge of finding the long-lost poem and discerning what they're able to about the dynamics of the poet's marriage and the circle in which he and his wife travel. The novel, again, is called What We Can Know, and Ian McEwan will be discussing the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library here in Baltimore, and he's been kind enough to join us today here on Midday on Zoom. If you'd like to join us, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Ian, you write so beautifully about history and about what that means and the various iterations of history that we create over time, and the distinction between history and memory. One of your characters says, memory is a sponge. It soaks up material from other times, other places, and leaks it all over the moment in question. And your famous poet, semi-protagonist Francis Blundy in this book says nearly all of life is forgotten. And that's profoundly true. When I read that sentence, I thought, boy, you've hit a nail on the head there. As you think about history and memory, you also write, or one of your characters says, there exists an unregarded entanglement of memory and physical distance. So talk about how history and memory are intertwined. Obviously, history is a very different thing than memory. People writing history in 2119 had no actual memory of what was going on in 2014, but they had plenty of sources to try to discern what was going on.
Yes, well, it's an interesting question about physical distance. So I'm away from home, about 3,000 miles. And although I have, the same emails, chatter, and all the connections that our inventions have allowed us, wherever I was on the face of the planet, if I put a few thousand miles between myself and my home, I feel distinctly different. And I'm not just talking about being in a different society with different expectations and so on. Oddly, I find myself thinking in different ways. Suddenly I'm outside some familiar things and my life. So for all our sort of globalized and connected world, physical distance still is a kind of holiday of the mind. One could think more expansively. Of course, some people get homesick. Parallel to that, there is a character in this novel who's a violin maker. He's not your average image of a violin maker. He's a big fellow, 6'4", bearded, strong arms, fat fingers, but he does the very delicate work of constructing violins. And he's married to Vivian, who will one day become the poet's wife. And their marriage is then disrupted by his getting Alzheimer's. And he goes through that terrible decline that is becoming more and more familiar to me as I advance through my life. And its main signal, as it were, is the loss of memory. The shrinking of memory means also the shrinking of identity. And as you all probably know, those of you who have Alzheimer's or dementia of some form in your lives, it's a massive burden on those who are close to you, those who love you. That loss of identity, because you have no sense of the past, is the personal drama that can be acted out by a society on a much larger scale. In other words, a society that loses its sense of history begins to lose, I think, its sense of identity. And that's why I included the story of the extraordinarily painful unfolding and diminishment of selfhood when you don't have any past at all. So, I guess I've had a lot of Alzheimer's in my own family. My mother died of it. Another close family member has just been diagnosed with it. I got maybe four friends who have it. And my son, William McEwen, is a researcher in the very subject. He's works in Cambridge running a group there. So it's very much in my mind that it's something that, as I say, is acted out. And I sense it now in our politics, that we no longer have anyone around in senior levels of politics who were active in the war or who grew up shaped by the war and who helped shape those institutions that were devised in a kind of horror of 90 million dead around the world in the Second World War. More civilians in this case than combatants. So the UN, NATO, the EU, all kinds of IMF, all kinds of institutions grew out of that. And in a slow kind of unravelment, I think, we have politicians who are prepared to take great risks undoing those institutions because I think some collective memory is beginning to fade.
Yeah, and even when you mentioned the war, I immediately thought of the Second World War. That's what you were referring to. There will come a time when the war no longer means that. There will be a generation for whom the war will be something else. Perhaps it's a war that hasn't taken place yet.
Absolutely.
And the way history is written, there is a personal investment by this researcher, Tom Metcalfe. I mean, he calls the essay that he wants to write about this poem his reputational essay. He is concerned about his own standing in academia and in the scholarly world that studies this very brief period of literature, which includes the dinner party and this poem. So he's got an agenda for himself. It's not just an agenda to be a truth teller or a finder of fact. And history is written by all sorts of people with that kind of personal agenda. And so that's going to color how it all comes out.
Absolutely. And of course, he's faced with his students who are rather tired of hearing about the inundations, which they call the flood, or all the dramas and catastrophic multi-million deaths of the 21st century. They're much more interested in a form of drum and bass music played with a two-string bass, not a four-string bass, and in the latest clothes fashions from Nigeria. Nigeria is the local hegemon, the local power. Nigeria, by the way, sometime this century will become the third most populous country in the world. And when I evoked those students who are rather impatient and who actually stage a walkout from one of Tom's seminars because they don't want to hear about any of this past again, I think of my own time. I grew up in the 50s, and by the time I got to the mid to late 60s, we had turned our back on our parents' experience of such a great calamity as the Second World War. We had rock and roll and paperback books and all kinds of educational opportunities. And I handed over, as it were, to my future students some of my own guilt about, you know, the way we regarded our parents. They seemed a little too attached to the ordinary routines of life. It was a time of people getting, you know, color TVs and mowing the lawn and polishing the car on a Sunday. Well, that was a generation that had been at the gates of hell when we did not fully understand it. And a return to ordinariness was for them a step towards paradise. So this just, it in the line of our discussion about turning your back on history, maybe has some parallel too in people being just tired of being warned or told about climate change.
And of course, what is ordinary going to be, you know, moving forward with AI, with which you've also written a good deal about, with climate change, with, you know, the developments in the universe happening so rapidly and so astonishingly. It's going to be difficult to even quantify what normal is. It's almost as if every moment is abnormal.
Exactly so. And my sense of things, though, and there is a slender line of nuanced optimism in this novel. It's not a dystopia. Is that just as in nature, when you stop doing bad things to it, it pushes back. And for example, and this is the example I often quote, off the coast of Northwest Scotland, there's 100 square miles where there's no fishing and no bottom scraping by those kinds of vessels do it. And marine biologists have been utterly astonished at the speed and variety of nature's pushback. The fish, the marine plants, the whole ecosystem, in a matter of 6 or 7 years, showing extraordinary resilience and copiousness. And I think that as long as we don't have a total planet ruining all out nuclear exchange, we'll see this same resilience in human societies. And I've been very interested in those organizations and foundations that want to accumulate some important information for the future in case there's a civilizational breakdown. So we could save people in the future a lot of time, even thousands of years, by telling them how to make soap, how to make glass, how to devise a 3 or 4 crop rotation, what a germ theory of disease would mean, our collective understanding how best to raise a child, etc. So we could start to express some responsibilities towards the future.
Do you find yourself then generally sanguine about the future as we finish up
here?
Well,
it's pretty dire, and I know that everyone who cares about climate change is particularly upset by the massive turning away from it by the US. There are some hopeful signs. That experiment that I've just described off the northwest coast of Scotland is being repeated tens of thousands of times over all around the world. We don't know about it and we don't connect it up. Also, I think the energy transition is unstoppable now. You can't turn it off at great speed in, say, the automobile industry, which has made already an enormous shift towards electric vehicles.
Yeah.
If we look at the number of solar panels that are exported out of China, we see that we could be near an inflection point on
we can certainly
renewable
hope.
Energy.
Yeah, we certainly can hope. And I look forward to continuing the conversation tomorrow night at the Pratt Libraries. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Look forward to seeing you then.
It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to meeting you.
Indeed. What We Can Know is the novel. Ian McEwan is the novelist. And again, we'll be at the Pratt Central Library tomorrow night. That is sold out, but you can go to the Pratt's website and put your name on a waiting list. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll learn about CTE training in city schools. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to member-supported 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.